Seattle's Morning News. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien, along with Heather Bosch and Chris Sullivan. Dave has the day off. Time for our weekly chat with moderator for Face the Nation, CBS's Margaret Brennan. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning.
We are particularly interested in an upcoming interview you have this Sunday with Microsoft President Brad Smith talking AI. That's going to be an interesting conversation.
It was. We spoke yesterday with Brad Smith here in town in Washington, where he publicly called for a number of things for the government to do to regulate and then eventually write new laws to help govern essentially the rules of the road for artificial intelligence, for AI. And he echoed the call from Sam Altman for the creation of a new government agency, an entirely new arm of the government, wow, just to oversee this kind of technology. So that is the scale of what Microsoft is predicting is about to come in the next few years in terms of the importance of AI in the workforce. Goldman Sachs has predicted AI would cost about 300 million jobs in the U.S. and Europe in years to come. Microsoft and others would argue it's also going to create new jobs we can't even quite conceive of yet. But I think the bottom line here is that there's big change coming down the pike.
Is it just me, or do you also feel like you've just been knocked over the head by AI, that it just came out of nowhere, even though we know it didn't? It's been under development for many, many years. But now all of a sudden, all of these tech CEOs calling it scary and that it needs to be regulated. That's not something we're used to. We're not used to companies asking for government intervention.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's why I also think it's important to talk about it in a way that I think can sort of catch the public up, because I feel like I'm playing catch up here. You're right. It went from, you know, sort of the back pages of the tech section to front page news very suddenly. And on Capitol Hill, lawmakers are holding hearings trying to figure out, you know, what does this mean? The White House just held a gathering of CEOs a few weeks ago to try to figure out government intervention. And at the G7 with world leaders, President Biden was talking about it as Japan and South Korea and other democracies try to craft laws. And by the way, the European Union is ahead in the United States, as are many of the Asian countries, in trying to create rules to govern AI. And what's interesting in the conversation with Brad Smith that you'll see on Sunday is we talk about some of the lessons learned, and I think that's instructive, which he's talking about, frankly, missteps where the government was slow to act in the Obama administration and Trump administration. They did not get out in front of trying to regulate social media. And now, years later, we're still grappling with, well, should there be regulation? And what is the impact on mental health? And, you know, is it good or bad for teenagers in the classroom? And exactly how much? All those questions that we now know in hindsight should have been asked and maybe accommodated for in social media are things that some of these tech CEOs are saying we should have a conversation about now with AI as it is getting going. Of course, critics would also say the big tech companies, the Microsofts and the Googles, are setting the rules of the road in a way that could stifle innovation from young startups. They would push back on that. But there's a very interesting dynamic here as some of the tech giants come out, like Microsoft, and call for regulation.
I want to turn quickly to the presidential election, because a few more names have entered the race, at least on the GOP side.
It's widening as a field, no doubt, with those two entrants this week, and we're hearing of more. You know, Mike Pence has said he would make a decision in June about whether he will officially enter the race. We are also hearing just this morning that North Dakota's Republican governor, Doug Burgum, who was a tech executive for years, that he may be eyeing a dark horse bid and could make that decision as soon as June the 7th. So this field is getting wider, and it is going to be really fascinating to watch how this develops, because, you know, in a lot of these initial polls, and we're very early on, it is, yes, the former president, the 45th president, Donald Trump, who is the front runner. But if that were a decided, you know, point for the party, then you wouldn't see all these Republicans throwing their hats in the ring and trying to unseat him. That says there is an appetite within the party among some for an alternative to Mr. Trump. The question is, who can put together that kind of alternative that is also viable and attracts the wide coalition he did in some ways of these very dedicated supporters who came, particularly working class Americans, and voted for him. Can another candidate do that? We'll have to see what the political prospects are here.
What kind of dance, Margaret, do these candidates have to do to, you know, not make the Trump base angry, yet, you know, woo them in some way, but not make the rest of the folks who may be souring on Mr. Trump, not to to make them turn their backs?
Well, that's the dance, isn't it? And it's really interesting to see the choices that some are making, whether they will even, for example, say the name of the former president. Nikki Haley, who served in the Trump administration, has been very careful in her language when she speaks about Mr. Trump, but she's been very pointed when it comes to being sort of on the attack when it comes to Ron DeSantis, a challenger from Florida. So, you know, it's not to say everyone is going to be careful. It's just that the fear there of alienating the Trump coalition is a very visceral one for candidates who want to ultimately put together a coalition that could win in a primary so that they become the party nominee. And then they have to worry about winning over the rest of the country in a head-to-head race with Joe Biden.
We'll have to see if they can break the record from, it seemed like a record back in 2015, 2016.
The 16 or 17, yeah.
Yes, you could barely fit them all on stage for the debates. It was so big, but it's shaping up to be that way again. Now, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the debt limit, and it seems like negotiations are at least going a little bit better as we near that date.
That's right. June the 1st is the date that the Treasury says is the X date, the date by which they will run short of funding to pay government obligations. The United States already surpassed the $31 trillion debt ceiling limit. And so the Treasury Secretary has been moving cash around. She has said she's running out of ways to be creative here, and therefore Congress needs to raise that ceiling. It looks like, as of last night, an emerging deal is taking shape, the contours of it. We know generally that it would lift the debt ceiling for 2 years, so that would get us past the presidential election, that it would put a two-year cap on some federal spending for non-defense discretionary, so that means spending on defense would still go up in 2024, spending on Veterans Affairs issue would still go up as well. Cuts would be elsewhere, and there'd be some creative accounting to move $10 billion from money already promised to the IRS and move it elsewhere. There's still questions about, will there be tighter work requirements applied to those recipients of government aid? Will there be permitting reform? That is a way to fast-track the ability for energy companies to drill in the United States and get those permits. Will that be attached? So this is not done. But we are in this final stretch, and for the first time, it does appear that both sides are signaling they may be able to come to an agreement.
And we know you'll be on top of it. CBS's moderator of Face the Nation, Margaret Brennan. You can catch her conversations this Sunday, especially the one with Microsoft President Brad Smith on artificial intelligence. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
Seattle's Morning News. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien, along with Heather Bosch and Chris Sullivan. Dave has the day off. One of the Oath Keepers who was part of the January 6th insurrection has been sentenced to 18 years in prison. CBS's Thane Rosenbaum has been following the case. Good morning, Thane.
Good morning, Heather. Good morning, Colleen.
So tell us, Rhodes was convicted of orchestrating the plot to attack the Capitol. Does this in any way exonerate the former president, Donald Trump?
He was very clear in addressing the court, the former head of the Oath Keepers, or the present head of the Oath Keepers, that in fact he wasn't responsible, that if anyone is responsible for January 6th, it was merely Donald Trump, and that they were there at the behest of Donald Trump, but they never received any official orders, but that the riot itself was generated by the president. The judge thought differently. He didn't seem to care about the direct connection between the president and the Oath Keepers. In fact, he kind of said that Rhodes, as the leader of the Oath Keepers, was responsible not only for the riot, but for also for, among other Americans, for undermining the legitimacy of the election in their efforts to overthrow the government. You know, you have to remember, this is a very serious charge, seditious conspiracy. We haven't seen it since 1995 with a few Islamists who attempted to blow up landmarks here in New York City. So it's rarely used. And on top of that, they added a terrorism charge to this. So the 18 years include this seditious conspiracy and a terrorism charge. And he's the first of any of the 1,000 people who were arrested. And that would include, I guess, 13 total Oath Keepers and Proud Boys that all faced the charge of seditious conspiracy. Rhodes is the first to actually be sentenced.
I find that interesting that even as they say, and I read the exchange between Rhodes and the judge, and it was quite heated, even as they say, you know, they were doing what the president told them to do, that they're almost throwing the president under the bus, even though they're some of his most staunch supporters.
There's a couple things that's interesting about Rhodes. First of all, he went to Yale Law School. I know people are like, what?
What?
Yeah. He went to Yale Law School. You know, he's obviously a very smart guy. And so he, you know, he fashioned a lot of the arguments himself in addition with his legal team. Secondly, he wasn't there. He wasn't actually there on January 6th. So you'd think, you know, if you're going to sentence the very first of the 13 people that were charged with seditious conspiracy, you sentence the one person of the 13 who actually wasn't there, but was being held out as the primary leader and the primary force of trying to overthrow the government and to cast doubt about the legitimacy of the election.
And yet, Thane, Stuart Rhodes makes no secret of his political beliefs. He's called himself a political prisoner. He's a very staunch advocate for what happened on January 6th. I'm curious if the government has any way to keep him from contacting his followers, because the judge flat out said he's concerned something might happen after the 2024 election.
You know, he, again, smart guy, right? He likened himself to Soviet dissidents, right? Talk about, you know, hitting below the belt, you know, our main enemy during the Cold War, the Soviet Union, those people that were legitimately trying to undermine the Soviet Union. He's saying, that's me. I'm just like the people that tried to bring down a corrupt government. He also invoked Franz Kafka, the Czechoslovakian writer Franz Kafka's infamous novel, The Trial, which is about the corruption of the legal system. Look, they're not going to probably keep him silent, but, you know, there is one, you know, ace in the hole that he has, which is that the government never actually established a direct link between the White House and the Oath Keepers. They may have shown up there on their own. And, you know, they said, you know, how can you convict us of a conspiracy? Conspiracy requires an agreement, a plan, a meeting where we all decided what we were going to do on January 6th. And, you know, there is an argument to be made that that isn't really what happened. That, you know, certainly there was no contact with the White House, but that he made the argument, look, yeah, it was horrible what happened, yes, but it was improvised and spontaneous. It was not a plan.
But Thane, don't they have records of texts and all this communication that happened in secret? Don't they have a bunch of that communication that happened?
And you know what they say? Trash talk. They say,
wow.
This is locker room guys.
Oh, right.
This is what locker room guys do. This is not a plan itself where our people were running around saying, let's bust into the Capitol. Let's take over the certification of the of electoral count. He's saying, yeah, it all happened, but it was in the moment, right? They're going to say it happened at the Ellipse.
Very interesting. CBS's Thane Rosenbaum, we appreciate your time.
Anytime for you both. Thank you.
7:15 on Seattle's Morning News. Good morning. Colleen O'Brien here. Dave has the day off. We have Heather Bosch with us, and you just heard from Sully. Now it's time for CBS White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy joining us live on the debt talks happening right now because June 1st is approaching. Stephen, good morning. What is happening with negotiations?
Well, good morning. I mean, the indication today is that the two sides are close to a deal for a 2-year agreement to raise the debt ceiling and cap federal agency spending over the course of the next 2 years. The details are still being worked out, but the fact is that the House of Representatives has gone out for the weekend. Speaker McCarthy, however, is staying here in D.C., and the president, he'll be at Camp David through the weekend, but not far away. And the White House says that the president can engage on this wherever he is. And the talks continue. There is some concern on the part of House progressives, Democrats, that perhaps the president's making too many concessions. And we'll see when and if a deal is announced in the next day or two or three, how they react when they see the fine print.
What exactly is the president giving up that's upsetting his allies?
The big concern that Democrats have expressed is that the president's prepared to make concessions on a couple of things. One, the $80 billion for new IRS agents that was part of the Inflation Reduction Act that the president signed into law last year. There are reports that about $10 billion of that would be redirected. So instead of $80 billion to hire new IRS agents, the White House says to go after tax cheats, about $10 billion of that would be redirected to agency spending to offset some of the reductions that Republicans have demanded. The other thing is Republicans have demanded that for able-bodied people without dependents who are on government assistance, that they should be required to have more hours of work, or that the ages of eligibility for the work requirement should be raised from 50 to 55. Democrats say that that would put more people into poverty, and they oppose it. Republicans say that we're borrowing from China to allow people to sit on the couch. That's the phrase invoked by the House Speaker in recent days. Ultimately, we'll see how aggressively the White House leans on House Democrats to get behind any agreement. The expectation is that Democratic votes will be necessary in the Republican-controlled House to get this through, because a great many Republicans are expected to sit on their hands and vote against it, arguing that the president hasn't agreed to cut enough.
Stephen, hi, Heather Bosch here.
Hey, Heather.
When it comes to these debt ceiling issues, this kind of appears to be a disaster of our own making. Members of Congress had to know this date was coming up. Why all the drama seemingly every time over this?
Well, it's been said that nothing important and significant in divided government happens here in Washington, D.C. without a deadline. And so we're up against that deadline. It's hard, given the political dynamic, and you have to understand that the challenge that Speaker McCarthy faces. He is going into this with a bill that he barely achieved passage of in his own Republican-controlled House that raises the debt limit, but repeals the Inflation Reduction Act, cuts the future growth of federal spending, and it was filled with what Democrats view as poison pills and wasn't a serious proposal in the minds of Democrats, but it was something that McCarthy could come to the table with and say, this is something that all Republicans in the House could get behind. The White House position is to say that the president proposed his budget more than 2.5 months ago, and that Speaker McCarthy perhaps isn't being serious in these negotiations, or at least not till now. But now the two sides are in the room. They are making progress. We heard that from the president yesterday. But you're absolutely right, Heather. This has come at a late stage. I will say the market reaction today has been positive. In the first roughly hour of trading, the Dow is up almost 300 points.
Sounds pretty good to me. So what happens to the average Joe and Jane if no deal is reached?
Well, it's hard to know that, Colleen. The reason is because the parade of horribles, right? The list of terrible things that could happen is long. You could face the prospect of the United States for the very first time not being able to meet its obligations that everyone counts on the Treasury to meet. Federal worker paychecks, Social Security checks, reimbursements to Medicare providers. These are some of the horrible things that have been forecast if the government does default. And the reason that this is the case is because every year the United States government spends more money than it takes in from taxpayers. And to meet that difference, the Treasury sells securities, bonds, to the international market. And that's how we cover the deficit the difference between how much we spend versus how much the government takes in. And that borrowing authority is capped by the debt ceiling. Unless it's adjusted, then the Treasury can't borrow any more money. Now, the Treasury still takes in tax revenue every time you get a paycheck and there's withholding. People make estimated tax payments, and that will happen through the month of June. But at a certain point, the cash flow it runs out. And the fear is that things could seize up, that certain payments that the people depend on the government to make might not be made. Exactly what those payments are is not clear, and the White House doesn't want to get into those specifics, in part because it might not be to their political advantage to get into those specifics, and in part because they don't have the answers yet.
Stephen, I have to ask about this. You've got a Memorial Day special coming up about the unsolved murder of a CBS News correspondent, George Polk. Tell me about that.
Really appreciate you asking. This is something I've been working on for the last 6 months. I'm very proud of it. I hope you listen. My understanding is that Cairo is going to run it at this time tomorrow morning, starting at 6. I hope that's right. The project is called Who Killed George Polk? And it's a story of our late CBS News colleague, George Polk. Perhaps you've heard of the George Polk Awards given out for courageous journalism. 75 years ago, our late colleague was murdered in Greece, where he was covering that country's civil war. It was a proxy war between Washington and Moscow, the right-wing, American-backed government of Greece against communist guerrillas aligned with Moscow at the very beginning of the Cold War. Our reporter, who was trying to dig into how American taxpayer dollars were being spent in Greece, had reason to believe that the right-wing government that was being backed by the U.S. was hoarding those American aid dollars. And he reported that on the CBS radio network, on Cairo in Seattle. He was killed. His body was found in a bay, his arms and legs tied. He was shot in the back of the head. Who killed him? We dig into that in our three-hour special. But beyond that, we also shine light on a cover-up involving U.S. government officials who conspired to hide the truth to advance American interests in the early days of the Cold War. It's a 75-year-old story, but there are modern echoes to it, because as journalists increasingly are coming under assault everywhere in the world, the idea of a reporter being targeted in 1948 because of what he was reporting is just as relevant now as it was three quarters of a century ago. I hope you listen. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Important journalism about important journalism. Stephen Portnoy, CBS's White House correspondent. We appreciate your time this morning.
You bet.
Time for your daily dose of kindness now, brought to you by Baird, focused on your financial needs since 1919. Surprise money. Nothing better than that. Whether it's your own, you find it in the pocket of your pants when it comes out of the dryer, or if it comes from a place of kindness. News 6 in Orlando has the story about mailbox money.
We are actually in Winter Garden, Florida.
How would you like the egg?
And the name of the restaurant is Eggs Up Grill.
The customers here are amazing. It's awesome. I love this place.
Tiffany Bender has been waiting tables at the Eggs Up Grill for about a year.
All right, what are we going to have?
But she has no idea.
These are all golden envelopes that are going to be given out today.
It's her turn to be served.
All right, here we go. We're going. Let's make it happen. Here we go.
You see, Joe Ferrer is on a mission, and he's going to make that sign above the kitchen a reality.
Everybody, we need a minute. We need a minute. We need a minute. Tiffany, come here. Tiffany, come here. So where's our golden envelope? We're going to give you a golden envelope. We are a large-scale kindness organization. We're going to give you golden envelopes. This is our server. And two dishwashers, we randomly pick them, open up your golden envelopes.
Ferrer is the founder of Mailbox Money. Envelope. And before the day is over, he and a group of volunteers will be giving away $10,000.
Really?
Are you kidding me?
$250 in cash there for
Thank
each of
so
them
much.
There.
But the good deeds didn't stop there.
You've all been golden enveloped in the spirit of Golden Envelope Day. We are paying for everyone's breakfast as well.
This random act of kindness is thanks to what Ferrer calls microphilanthropy, a worldwide membership where people donate as little as 10 bucks a month.
So one thing that makes us unique is that we're not needs-based. We don't focus on that. We believe that everyone deserves kindness.
And I waited on them. And I was like, you guys look like you're up to something good. So I had no idea.
Good day. Need more like it, huh? What you gonna do with that money?
Oh, I can't tell my wife. I know that again.
From there, it was off to the next stop.
So they're gonna give them the golden envelope as they come around there.
Here, they paid for every drive-through order and took care of the staff as well.
People watch it and they think, oh, well, that just happens to other people. But we're just trying to show if we can inspire more kindness, it can happen to anyone.
The hope is people will pay it forward. And back at the diner, that's exactly
what happened. All right, got it. Thanks.
The people that were here at that time, they gave our other servers money too, because they just felt generous at that time.
What if? What if what we're doing achieves what I think it can? The world can change.
That story from News 6 in Orlando.
Come fly with me. Let's fly away.
Not sure if I can sing coming off of a three-day cold, but here we are. Ursula Roitin joining us this morning from the G and Ursula Show.
Good morning.
Needs no introduction.
Oh,
Heather Bosch is here too. Chris Sullivan is here. The whole gang is here to talk about the do's and don'ts of flying. It's a big weekend for flying.
It is. And we had so much fun yesterday talking about airline etiquette and what you can and cannot do on an airplane.
And
a flight attendant had come up with, exactly, a flight attendant came up with a list. And I wanted to run a couple of these by you guys and see where you stand on this. So this is, again, from a flight attendant. She came up with her 12 rules for air travel. And I'm going to go through a couple. One is everyone has the right to recline, but there's a polite way to do it. Oh. So what is your take on reclining? Do you recline?
I do.
Do you ask if you can before you do, or you just go?
No, but I don't do it like jerky. I don't go like bam and slam it back. Like, I do it gently to let them know this is happening, accept it, and then it stays that way.
Sully?
Well, since I always fly first class.
You're like me. We're in the back.
Yeah, we're in the if I'm not in the last seat, which can't recline because you're next to the bathroom, I do slowly, maybe a little. It kind of depends if, you know, if everybody's doing it, I kind of do it. But I've reclined less these days than I used to.
Well, I think also the chairs don't let you recline very much. The last plane I was on, I swear it was like an inch and a half, and that was it.
Well, there's a reason. So they say, don't slam your chair back without warning. And this flight attendant says, before reclining, look behind you and see what the situation is, and then nicely ask if that person minds.
Now,
the question is,
really? No, I'm not going to ask because it's part of the seat.
Yeah, I paid for my cruddy seat and coach.
And what happens
if the most out of it?
What happens if the person says no?
Yeah, the only time I do it actually is if the person in front of me is reclined and I've got my nose to the back of the seat. I'm going back.
Yeah, it's a domino effect.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, the overhead bins are not your personal Tetris game. So, what is your? Do you generally find overhead space right above your seat, or do you just go for the first space available?
I thought it was a rule that what's above your seat is yours.
Yeah, except that a lot of times, by the time you get to your seat, it's full.
Right, which is not supposed to happen. And in that case, I'll find whatever I need.
Yeah, so she says the bins are first come, first serve in economy class. You don't own the spot directly above your seat. And it's not acceptable to take out someone else's bag to make yours fit. Okay.
Don't touch other people's
stuff. But here's the big one. Keep your socks on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you do, though, if your seatmate does take off their socks and suddenly their feet are up against the seat, you know?
Take a picture and shame them on the internet.
I prefer the direct approach. Put your darn shoes.
You would do that?
Would you actually tell
someone? Ranger?
Have you ever had to do...
Oh, my gosh. If they were sitting right next to me, dude, put your shoes back on. Put your socks on.
Bold.
Sully?
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever had to...
No.
Okay. What if someone is...
I mean, Holly usually keeps her socks on.
Okay. What about if your seatmate is chewing tobacco and then spitting into a bottle and then putting it in? This just happened to a friend of mine and she posted about it. And then putting the spit in the pocket in front.
I'd be fine with that because I grew up with guys who we chewed in class and we'd stick it in. Yeah, we do. Yeah. But again, that's super gross. I get it. But I'm used to that.
If he stayed in his own little area with it. Yeah,
but you're so close together. I mean, it's gross. I mean, I guess if you are someone who chews, would you please wait on that one? So the flight attendant says, no one wants to smell your feet.
Yeah.
Don't put them anywhere but below your seat. And she says, I highly recommend putting your footwear back on to use the bathroom.
Yeah. Who's walking to the bathroom with socks or bare feet? Oh.
Okay. How about this? We just got a few seconds
we've
left.
Got time.
How about deal? Okay. You don't have to switch seats if someone asks you.
That's true.
You ever been in a situation where someone has said, I got my kids here?
Oh, if it's they want to sit by their kids,
yes.
I'm usually, unless it's a really bad trade, I'm usually sympathetic.
Usually,
to that.
Yeah,
me too.
It's the flight attendants who come up and say, well, someone's going to be sitting next to a 2-year-old, you know, unless one of you moves.
Like, right.
Okay.
Exactly. So what are your...
I was going to ask you the same thing.
Though.
You're our guest. I want you to, what's your number? Because we're going to be flying to New York here pretty soon.
We are. We're going to be flying together.
For the Gracie Awards. Yeah. These two women both won Gracies.
Thank you. my biggest pet peeve is if someone hasn't bathed in a while.
So they have a big odor.
And they are very,
pungent.
And because I am very sensitive, my smell is very sensitive. And I also have a very easy gag reflex.
Oh, no.
I have to ask you.
And I don't know what you do about
I have
that.
To ask
other
you
than,
ladies, this. Yeah. I had a guy sitting next to me, and he was falling asleep, and he kept leaning on me. And he kept apologizing, oh, I'm just really tired. But he wasn't leaning on the dude on the other side of him. He kept, like, falling on me. And I felt bad because after a while, I was just jabbing him with my elbow. Like, dude, I'm sorry you're sleep deprived, but you don't get to pass out on
me. I think that's perfectly okay.
Yeah,
yes.
It was pretty rude.
Mine is, everybody stay seated until it's your time to exit the plane. That's my biggest pet peeve, is the landing. When everybody goes, everybody stands up.
And gets,
that's my biggest pet peeve, because you're not going anywhere.
I
get needing to stretch, but it's the inching out into the aisle. Trying, and it's like, you're not going anywhere. What is that human nature?
I have been guilty of that, just where I stand up, just because I've been sitting the whole time.
Sure.
But I get it. I think we're all in a rush. And that always seems like the longest part of the flight, waiting to get off the plane.
And then somebody who's legitimately going to miss their flight and they need to get through the aisle.
Yes.
This has happened before, and I've had to like be her bodyguard, where I'm like, she's going to miss a flight. Get out of the way, people. Sit down. You know? So anyway, that's my biggest pet peeve.
Love it. Well, I just encourage everybody to take a deep breath.
Yeah.
A lot of people are going to be frustrated out there this weekend.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ursula. This was cathartic.
I didn't even know you can't legally chew on a plane, can you? Isn't that a tobacco product?
Exactly. But apparently it happened and she didn't know what to do. And in that case, I would have said, excuse me.
Yeah.
That's not okay.
Any good Copenhagen user would swallow it anyway. I mean, come on.
No. 8:48 on Seattle's Morning News. I'm Colleen O'Brien. We have Heather Bosch in the house. Sully's here. Mickey Gomez is here now, too. We're talking baby names and the growth of some really popular names. I'm surprised at what makes the top for some of these baby names.
Yeah, seriously. The country's fastest rising baby name last year was Everly.
For a girl.
For a girl. I'd never heard of Everly before.
Really?
Never have. And... they also this article from Axios, by the way, also talks about the names that dropped off the top 10 list. So there's a big list. So Everly, Nova, and Amelia are the top rising names of 2022-2023. So if you're going to have a girl, that's what you should name her.
Or not.
If you
don't
exactly.
want her to have the same name as a lot of little girls. What surprised me the most, though, is that Everly... Two different spellings top the list.
Yep.
Everly, Everleigh. It grew 24.7 times.
Yep.
And Everly, Everly, which is the more traditional spelling, by the way, that grew 14.1. Also the name of my niece. So I reached out to my sister knowing we were going to do this.
Uh-huh.
And it's Everly, Everly.
I like that way.
Spelling.
I like the spelling of it that way. Yeah.
I think traditional name spellings really never go out of style easier. But, you know, and that's not to diss anybody who changes the spelling, right? My daughter is Elliot, not Elliot, but Elliot, which is the French feminine.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked her, I said, where did you hear of the name Everly? And apparently these days, the popularity may come from a really big influencer.
Yes, a YouTuber. She's 10 years old. She's got like 3.9 million subscribers. She opens up.
Wow.
So companies will send her things and she like opens them up and tries them out. And she's a little fashionista now.
And her name's Everly.
And her name is Everly LeBrant. And that's where they think that some of the popularity of that name came from.
For my sister, and my niece is almost 10, she said she had heard the name Ever. Like, and she thought it was beautiful. Like, your life's about to change forever. And she thinks Alanis Morissette named her son Ever. And as she was researching that name, she saw the Everly, the more feminine approach to it.
Pretty.
And that's where it came from.
Nice.
So, but now, you know, it's funny when, like, you have this roundabout way of finding what you think is a unique name. And a few years later, suddenly it's the most popular name.
It is. True.
I was the only Heather when I was little, the only, flat out the only Heather. And when I was about 14, every toddler in the world, I swear, was named Heather. I'd be walking down the mall and I'd hear some woman yell, Heather! Yeah. What did I do? What did I do?
Well, there's a reason why I go by the name Mickey, because the year I was born, Lisa was the most popular name. And there were 7 Lisas in my class.
Oh, wow.
So the teacher said, we're going to go by middle names. So there was Lisa Ann, there was Lisa Kay, there was Lisa Marie, there was Lisa Michelle. I'm Lisa Micaela.
Micaela.
So the teacher finally looked at me and she goes, you're just going to be Micaela. And then nobody could pronounce it. So then it became Mickey.
Chris, you have no problems with your name, right?
No, not at all. I mean, it does rhyme with a couple of things that some, you know, 10 or 11 year old boys could make fun of. But that's how I'm named Tommy. I mean, because Thomas was, I was like, okay, what can he be abused by? Tommy, Thomas, you know what? I'm like, yeah, that's pretty safe. Mm-hmm. And it gave him some options. So yeah, I just never put into something strong like that and didn't really think too much about it.
Yeah, but Heather does not translate well because, it's a flower. So in some cultures, it's little pink weed.
But when I think of Heather, I think of Heather Locklear.
Ooh. Oh, right. Oh,
yeah. And I love the name Elliot.
Thank you.
And I've never met a girl Elliot until we moved to the Pacific Northwest. I know 5 of them.
You know 5 of them.
I don't know your daughter, but I know that her name is Elliot. And so my best friend, my daughter's best friend is an Elliot. And then she's got and then there are a couple of other Elliot Spring. And I'm like, this is adorable.
I love it when she corrects people, this little thing. They're like, Elliot. She's like, it's Elliot.
Oh, I love that.
Let's talk about the names that are dropping off in popularity.
Yeah. So
I think most people can guess the top girl name dropping off in popularity.
Alexa.
Oh, you just turned on everyone's device.
Yeah, so that's that had the largest drop. Alexa was actually a very popular name, but because of the device Alexa, people were like, mm-mm. Alexis.
For same reason.
Yep. Michaela.
Which, I love that name.
I do, too. Yeah. It's my name. Well, Micaela.
Micaela.
Yeah. There's Alyssa and Lauren.
Okay.
And then if you're a guy, your popular guy names are Theo, Maverick, Walker. Those sound like cowboy names, right?
Maverick.
Yes. And Walker.
That is strong.
And then the boy names that aren't as popular anymore. Gavin, Brandon. I didn't know Brandon was back. Blake, Tyler,
and Braden.
Chris Sully.
Sully. That name has dropped way off.
Yeah, Blake, yeah. Braden, Brandon.
Like
those are names that I remember from Tommy's, like when he was some of his younger friends. There were bunches of them.
Yeah.
Especially Balake. Yeah, Blake was a good one.
I'm just glad I'm done and I don't have to decide on names anymore. That is such a big stress as you're pregnant, choosing the right name. I just knew that my second was June. She was always June in my tummy when she came out.
Those
and
are
even
beautiful.
Today.
Mine is my daughter's name. We named her Jada. We were going to name her Yada.
Oh.
But we didn't name her Yada because we thought people would make fun of her if she talked a lot like me.
Yada, yada, yada.
Yada, yada, yada. Oh. So we went with Yada. Now she's Gigi.
Gigi, I love that. Well, thank you for sharing.
You're always welcome.
Fun talking names, Nikki.
It.
And it's good to have you back in the studio,
I'm
too.
Happy to be back.
You feeling good?
Feeling better.
I'm glad.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.